from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Silicon Glen, Silicon Alley, Silicon Wadi, Silicon Mountain. So many places want what we have here in the San Francisco Bay Area. But why did it happen here? Why does any particular place become a hot zone of innovation and creativity? Why do these golden ages inevitably come to an end? Former NPR reporter Eric Weiner tackles these questions in his latest book, The Geography of Genius, a globe-trotting investigation into the secrets behind collective human ingenuity throughout the ages. That's all coming up in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny, who's on vacation. Our culture loves the myth of the tortured, solitary genius toiling away in a fetid garret, unappreciated until after he dies, usually. That's a 19th century trope, according to journalist and author Eric Weiner, who's traveled the world to construct a different theory that genius is a social construct usually found in dynamic urban areas. That's the crux of his argument in his new book, The Geography of Genius, and he joins us in studio to talk about it now.
Hi, Rachel. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, I guess to kick off the conversation, I'd like to ask how you define genius. How do you know you're looking at something that is genius?
Ah, that is the big question. I think that genius, someone is a genius if other people agree they're a genius. And I know that sounds a bit crazy because, as you sort of alluded to with your, I thought, very robust, almost Shakespearean performance there of the tortured artist, you know, that is the myth, that they're alone and that it is something immutable that transcends time and space. But that's not true. You need sort of a social verdict to declare someone a genius. You know, if you were to go back to your, you know, basement apartment in Palo Alto or wherever and work on the great American novel, and you're convinced, my God, you've written the great American novel, but, you know, your friends don't agree, your spouse doesn't agree, no publishers agree, you're not a genius. So we, as I say in the book, we get the geniuses that we want and that we deserve. And hopefully, you know, we're cultivating the right kind of genius. And the social verdict is right and not capricious. And we find Mozart to be a genius and maybe Kim Kardashian less so. But ultimately, I think it is a social verdict.
But then couldn't we have disagreements? Like some people think Donald Trump is a genius. Others think not.
Right.
You know?
But it settles out. I mean, we all agree that Mozart was a genius. And by the way, not a musical genius only, but a genius because genius doesn't require modification. It transcends its own field. Einstein, a genius. Beethoven.
Even though he couldn't sing a tune, he couldn't, you know, cook
right.
Like Julia Child.
But his I won't say expertise, but that's not the right word. His transcendent ability, not to be a know-it-all, but to be a see-it-all and see connections that others didn't. Because let's be clear here, there were other physicists who knew more physics than Einstein during his day. But what Einstein did was make connections that others didn't. And that's always what the genius does.
There's a conceptual leap.
There's one of my favorite quotes about genius is from the German philosopher Schopenhauer, who says that talent hits the target no one can hit. Genius hits the target no one can see. And I would add crucially that once they hit that target, the rest of us have to see it too and go, oh, yeah, there was a target over there. Otherwise, you're just delusional. You're hitting invisible targets.
So now your previous book, The Geography of Bliss, took a similar approach in this. You know, it's the geography of.
Right.
What is it about place that you think is so connected to these critical qualities of life?
I mean, I will confess right here, Rachel, I'm a place person. You know, there are dog people, cat people, word people, numbers people. I'm a place person. You know, I believe that where we are shapes who we are in profound ways. And just what do I mean by place and geography? I don't just mean the topography or the climate. I mean culture. That culture affects us in ways we're not aware of. And we're not aware of it for the same reason that the fish is not aware that they're in the water. It's not till you remove the fish from the water and they go, oh, that's water. I've been in water the whole time. And so that's the advantage of being an outsider. That's why it took a Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, to explain American democracy to Americans, because he was the fish out of water, so to speak. And I believe that place matters for happiness, as I explained in the Geography of Bliss. And I really do believe it matters for creative genius, and it matters much more than we think.
So how did you go about coming up with a short list of places you were going to visit to explore
very
these questions?
Carefully and very painfully, because, you know, I could easily have written a 2,000-page book, because there have been quite a few of these golden ages, or genius clusters, as I call them. But ultimately, I was looking for kind of a cross-section of places. You know, I didn't want to just hang out in Western Europe, which would be easy enough to do. So I had some familiar places from Europe, like classical Athens or Renaissance Florence, and then some less familiar places like Edinburgh in the 18th century, the Scottish Enlightenment, and then some really unfamiliar places like Hangzhou, China in the 13th century during the peak of the Song Dynasty, and Calcutta in the late 19th, early 20th century, which was home of a little-known flourishing called the Bengal Renaissance. And, of course, Silicon Valley in the end. Bring it home.
You have a wonderful quote from Plato in the book that really struck me. What is honored in a country will be cultivated there. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
I love that. In fact, it's the epigraph of the book. And it's so short and simple and genius, really. And it seems obvious, but it's also profound. What is honored in a country will be cultivated there. So again, we get the geniuses that we want and that we deserve. You know, in 18th century Vienna and early 19th century, you have this huge flourishing of classical music. Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, Schubert, all intersecting. Now, where are those musicians today? Have you heard of the name Thomas Addis?
No.
A-D-E-S. No. He's probably the greatest classical composer of our day. British composer, does fantastic work. Now, is he not as good as Mozart? Or do we just honor music less? I mean, there are two things going on.
We have great musical geniuses.
We do.
They're just working in genres that are more, shall we say, modern and appreciated by modern audiences.
That might be true. But a certain kind of music was honored in the 18th century, and it's not honored
and
today.
And remunerated by very wealthy patrons.
Exactly. That's a form of honoring, is money, right? So that is the ultimate form of honor, right?
Gotta pay your rent.
Yeah.
And most musicians are not born wealthy.
Right, right. And so I think there are two things going on. One is that in the 18th century Vienna, if you were smart and ambitious and you wanted to make a name for yourself, you went into what we now call classical music, and they just called music back then. Today, if you're smart and ambitious, you're probably less likely to go into classical music and more likely to head to Silicon Valley, for instance. And the second aspect, though, is the recognition aspect, that even if you are a fantastic composer like Thomas Addis, you're not going to receive the level of recognition that a Mozart did. So, you know, we get what we honor and what we care about. And right now we care a lot about technology. And so we get a Steve Jobs or a Mark Zuckerberg as our geniuses. And I'm doing the air quote thing, which you can't see on the radio because it's controversial.
It is controversial. I mean, when you say Steve Jobs is a genius, I'm one of those people who thinks, I don't think I character. He was successful. He was very good at cultivating other people's genius. But was
at borrowing
he,
from
at,
others?
At borrowing from others, at popularizing, at tinkering. You were talking earlier about
right.
a conceptual leap. And, you know, aside from the concept of divine design, consumer-friendly design, I don't know that he was making conceptual leaps.
Okay. Well, if you want to apply for a U.S. patent, you have to meet three criteria, and I think they apply to genius as well. Your invention has to be new, useful, and surprising. And does Steve Jobs meet those? Well, useful
well,
part.
This has been a matter of huge court cases.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's you know, you ask people in a room, you know, a cocktail party, was Steve Jobs a genius? And it's divided
yeah.
almost right down the middle. But he's the closest thing we have, probably. And, I, you know, can you name someone else who would fit that category?
Oh, my gosh. There were so many different people. I mean, like, I think one of the stories about Silicon Valley is that you have people working in collective teams together. You know, Hewlett and Packard. There were people who were working together.
More jobs in Wozniak.
Exactly. And not necessarily, you know, this gets back to, of course, distancing ourselves from that one solitary person.
Right. We have this very romantic 19th century, 18th century view of genius. You know, I think it is true that geniuses are the secular world's gods. And if you look at the adulation of Steve Jobs and the real heartfelt mourning when he passed away, it was almost like a holy man had died. And I think we relinquish this myth reluctantly of the lone genius. But, you know, if it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a city to raise a genius. Silicon Valley, though, is the outlier in my book because it began not as a city, but as sort of exurbia or even...
And now it's grown to basically eat the entire San Francisco Bay Area.
Right. It's become urbanized, essentially. But you need some density for those interactions, and you need some intimacy and trust. You know, prisons are dense too, but they're not very creative.
Yeah. So what is it about density that cultivates genius?
Well, I think it's the interaction opportunities, first of all, that you have. Picture a container with molecules banging against each other and colliding and forming new groupings. The more molecules you have in there, the more chance of groupings. But again, I think density alone is not enough because, again, prisons are dense and slums are dense, but don't produce that much in the way of genius. So looking at all these genius clusters I examined, I realized there was intimacy, there was a sort of cross-pollination of ideas. You look at 18th century Scotland, and in the same building, you would have a wealthy person and a poor person living cheek by jowl. You need to have different kinds of molecules bumping up against each other and not the same exact one.
And another point you make in the book is that it's not just space, it's time. That many of these cities really flowered for a brief moment, a few decades, and then gone.
They're fragile things. They don't last long. And, you know, let's talk about Silicon Valley. People wonder. That's always been the question. How long is it going to last? Now, when I talk to people in Silicon Valley, they say, rightfully so, people have been predicting its demise since the 1970s, really.
Which was already 20 years into the
right.
first
so flower. People yeah. keep predicting its demise, and it keeps, you know, proving them wrong. But I think people should remain on guard and wary, and particularly on guard against what one historian calls creeping vanity. Now, he was talking about ancient Athens, but it applies to all golden ages. And I think all these genius clusters become places of genius for different reasons, but they tend to collapse for more or less the same reason, which is arrogance, this creeping vanity. And it is creeping. It sneaks in, you know. You don't wake up one day and all of a sudden you're arrogant. It's just you become very confident that you've been top dog and you're always going to be top dog. That and maintaining this openness, this fluidity. You don't see a lot of genius coming out of North Korea. Why? You know, it's not that people have a high IQ there or that they don't work hard. They do. It's a closed system. It's not an open system. And all these places I look at, from Athens to Florence to Calcutta to Silicon Valley, were open systems with a free flow of ideas coming in, ideas going out.
Well, you know, that raises an interesting question. I mean, these days, in the age of airplane travel and the internet, people will go where the action is happening. I'm thinking of Paris in the 1920s, for that matter.
People always have gone to where they – but they can go a little more quickly and easily now. That's true.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the reasons why this golden age keeps expanding and continuing is because we have the benefit of all of this intelligence and creativity coming from all over the country, from all over the world.
And let's not forget that people come to Silicon Valley and people leave Silicon Valley. So it's not only a magnet for talent, it's a colander that sifts out the people who are, well, it sounds a bit harsh, but less talented, or at least their ideas don't fit in the time and place. So it's not enough to just be open and tolerant. That's important, but you need to have discernment. You know, Jonas Salk, two-time Nobel Prize winner, was asked by a student, well, Dr. Salk, how do you come up with so many good ideas? And he said, well, it's easy. I come up with lots of ideas and I throw out the bad ones. And that's, I think, what Silicon Valley is particularly good at is discernment and throwing out the bad ones. You know, well, not a lot was invented.
One of the aspects of this culture, though, is we worship or at least respect failure. The idea that an individual might have some bad ideas or good ideas that came at the wrong time before the right one hits.
Yes. Do we worship failure really? I think we worship failure as a backstory to success. So, you know, if you tried a few things and it didn't work out, but then you become Steve Jobs, that's a great story. But
I read many, many articles in the early 1990s, especially mm-hmm. in the Wall Street Journal, you know,
right.
all these smart Wall Street analysts saying, it's just a blip. Look at the tiny percentage of the market they own. Microsoft. I mean, like people didn't see it until it was successful.
Right.
I would say that the genius was there before the success was recognized by people elsewhere.
Getting back to what I call the fashionista theory of genius, the recognition is important. You can't separate the creative act from the recognition. And that's what I think Silicon Valley is good at, is recognizing talent, recognizing good ideas, and recognizing ideas that are ripe, that ripeness factor. And I think that's hugely important. It's almost, I would say, actually more important. The recognition of talent and genius is actually more important than the creation of it, you know. And that's what, you know, the Medici's in Florence were so good at it. You know, they were patrons, but they didn't just throw their money around helter-skelter. They were very discerning and made good choices, good bets. And sometimes they were risky, but a lot of them paid off.
So now I got to ask, you've got a daughter. You're hoping the best for her.
Right.
Don't you owe it to her to move out here?
Oh, I didn't think of that. Wow. Well, now that makes a big assumption, Rachel. You are putting Silicon Valley on the same pedestal as classical Athens and Renaissance Florence?
Yeah.
Really?
It's so generative. And I mean, you know, technology, these days we're talking about iPhones, but we're really talking about wave upon wave of technological revolution, not just in terms of personal technology, but medicine and military might. And I mean, there are all these different realms of interconnectedness.
So you would distinguish Silicon Valley from, say, Detroit, which was a one-note town.
Exactly. Hmm. And there have been, I mean, like, Silicon Valley isn't a place. It's a conceptual umbrella term to describe a lot of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Right.
And we have launched more than one revolution in the last half century.
Right. But all having to do with technology.
No, there's politics. There's food. I mean, you know, even now we are a feeder team to the systems of Wall Street in Washington, D.C. I can name a couple people, Leon Panetta, Janet Yellen. I mean, we can go down the list. Alice Waters, Shea Panisse. I mean, these are people who launched huge revolutions that have echoed far beyond our borders.
That's true. When people think of Silicon Valley, they tend to think of technology.
Yeah.
And in fact, it doesn't really have much to do with technology. The product is technology, but the same...
It's an umbrella term.
The technology is the product, but really what makes Silicon Valley special, and it's true of all these places, is the creative ecology. It's a processing system for ideas, separating the good one from the bad ones, and slotting in the good ones so that if you come to Silicon Valley and you have what's determined to be a good idea, they will say, oh, well, you should talk to so-and-so, who should talk to so-and-so, who should talk to so-and-so. And there is, I think, the right mix of competition and cooperation. A fascinating study I came across found that we cooperate best with those with whom we once competed. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. But there's something to that. That's, you know, the line between adversary and teammate is a bit blurred in the Valley, and that's a good thing, I think.
What do you think it is about competition? I guess maybe it just spurs us to do our best.
Well, this is when I was researching the book. Part of my research was reading a lot of academic papers, social science papers on on what motivates us and on what's the field of creatology, as it's sometimes called. And then sort of looking historically and looking at these real world examples, and sometimes they didn't agree, and competition's one area. You know, there's something called the intrinsic theory of motivation, which is very popular and has a lot of academic papers backing up, that says basically, if I, you know, give you, Rachel, a bunch of material and say, make a collage, you're going to do better if I say, just have fun making the collage. And I say, make a collage. You have 25 minutes. If you do a good job, I'll pay you $100 and promote your work, you know, at the museums of San Francisco. That extrinsic motivation is not good, right? And on some level, that makes sense. We do best when we're just told to have fun. But the real world shows us something different. The real world is that in Renaissance Florence, Leonardo and Michelangelo hated each other. And it brought out the best of them. And I've heard there might be a little bit of rivalry in Silicon Valley as well. I sort of square that circle with one study that brought it all together for me, where these psychologists looked at experienced musicians, not novice in the field, you know, maybe people who have been practicing music for 5 or 10 years, and said, go ahead and improvise. And the people who were told to have fun didn't do as well as the people who were given rewards. And I think competition kind of hinders us if we're novices, but it brings out the best of us once we're experienced and once we have some confidence. So
it gets back to that idea that you can't be arrogant if you're worried about someone else eating your lunch.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Max writes in, why is your guest talking about classical music of 2015? If we're going to talk about genius and place in music, I need to remind you that David Bowie lived in New York. Please ask your guest about New York.
New York was one of the places I thought about including in my book. But which period? it sort of hummed along. It's hit various peaks. You know, the 50s and 60s, there was art and music has been going on for quite a while. And David Bowie is a good example of someone who owes their genius at least in part to the time. He came along at the right time. And he certainly added to that time, but if he was born 20 or 30 years earlier, would we still know the name David Bowie? I'm not so sure. And a fat little tidbit.
And of course, he started in London and in England at a time of great cultural foment.
And he spent some time in Berlin, and he spent time in New York. And that brings us to another point, is that geniuses tend to be peripatetic. They move around. And a disproportionate number of geniuses are immigrants or refugees. And that is fascinating because I think they bring a fresh perspective and they bring a contagion. Once an immigrant arrives, everyone becomes more creative.
Good ideas catch on. We're talking with Eric Weiner about his book, The Geography of Genius. Do you think genius is a function of place mostly, or do you think other factors matter more? Call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Tweet to @KQEDForum. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. We're talking to Eric Weiner about his new book this hour, The Geography of Genius. And the phone lines are lighting up, but I'd like to encourage you to join into the conversation. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Tweet to @KQED Forum. Ralph writes in, hubris much? Tech has an ego problem that is, and this comes in all caps with many, many U's, huge. Don't buy into their loopy self-glorification, people. Skip writes, there is the touted mantra in Silicon Valley that 90% of high-tech companies were founded by an immigrant or the son of an immigrant or the grandson of an immigrant or the great grandson, you get the idea. But they never mention how many of these companies were successful. The idea that we are somehow dependent on foreign intelligence is a myth. We are capable not only of governing ourselves and defending ourselves, but managing our own economy ourselves as well. This is what Yankee ingenuity is all about. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, boy. I'm not sure where to begin. I mean, it's true that there is genuine ingenuity, homegrown ingenuity in Silicon Valley. But again, the North Koreans might say, we don't need no outsiders. We can manage our own ingenuity. It doesn't work that way. But I think there might be a misunderstanding about how immigrants help stir things up creatively. You know, it's a very smart psychologist at UC Davis named Dean Simonton. He looked at Japan, a country that's been closed historically over a long period of time, like 1,500 years, and found out that the more Japan opened its doors to foreigners and to all kinds of cultural imports, the more accomplishments it had in Japan, not necessarily because of those immigrants directly, but because it opened Japanese eyes to the possibility of possibility. So when you see things done another way, you may not say, oh, I'm going to do it that way. I never thought of X. I'll do it X. No, you may do Z or you may do P. But it opens your eyes to simply that there's another way of doing it. And if you're in a closed system, you're not going to be open to that possibility.
Going back to David Bowie, one of the things he did was maintain an open mind throughout his career. He would check out other people's music. He would go to performances. And oftentimes your creativity is sparked by seeing somebody else do something and saying, I can do that better, or I'd like to go in a slightly different direction.
Right. Or while we're talking about pop music, look at Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. You know, their first album sold only 30,000 copies. But as Brian Eno said, only half jokingly, every one of the people who bought one of those 30,000 copies started a band. So there are some people who have an exponentially large impact on the music scene or any cultural scene. And they're multipliers in a way, and every culture has them. The Renaissance Florence had it as well. There was a man named Verrocchio, so-so artist, but who ran a workshop that brought up many young talents, including Leonardo da Vinci.
Let's go to the phones now, and Robin in San Francisco.
Good morning. God, I'd love to ask your guest a dozen questions, but I know there's only time for a couple. One is the question of how ego plays into somebody's success. Obviously, you had the two Steves of Apple, and one couldn't have made it without the other. And the other question is, I'm assuming that because this kind of a breeder atmosphere in a place like Silicon Valley kind of feeds on itself, that makes it kind of impossible for you to export it to areas that are economically depressed that could really use the boost, you know, like Detroit, and also maybe the reasons why people in China that are creative come to the U.S. because they can't do those kind of things in China, and why we're looked at as still an innovator and they're just looked at as copiers.
Okay, there's a lot there. Let me try to tease it out. I found that throughout history and right up to Silicon Valley today, there's something I call compensatory genius. There is one genius is lacking something. The founder of modern geology named James Hutton from 18th century Scotland was a brilliant geologist, really the first geologist, and had a miraculous theory that the Earth was older than 6,000 years, which is what everyone thought at the time. And he wrote it up in a paper. But he was a terrible, terrible writer. Turgid prose. No one could read it. He had a friend named John Playfair, who was a brilliant writer, and spiced it up and made it readable. And so Playfair was the compensatory genius. Look at the two Steves, Wozniak and Jobs. They had complementary talents. One was more of a marketer. One was more the geek. And that's always the case. And I think when it comes to ego, boy, it's a fine line, isn't it, between self-confidence and arrogance. You need some ego to create. You know, Einstein was a supremely self-confident man, but he also knew what he didn't know. You know, that's what Socrates says. The only true knowledge is that we don't know. And you need to have some of that ignorance as well. And I think
an awareness of that ignorance.
Awareness of that ignorance, yes. And the second part of the caller's question, I guess, is he getting at the question of why we can't export Silicon Valley, why there's only one, and why Silicon Wadi is not the same level of success? Is that the question, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If there's a particular place that's known for being open,
right,
to
then
to,
people go there.
Right. Am I getting this right, Robin?
Well, yeah, it's kind of like you hear about why it's so tough to keep this going in the Bay Area because the price of housing is so expensive. Well, why not move some of this to, say, a place like Detroit where it's really depressed because it's so much cheaper to live there and to do all this work? But, you know, is there no way you can have that kind of atmosphere to create this type of a magic in a place like Detroit just simply because it's Detroit?
Yeah, I think it's extremely difficult to transplant a culture, and Silicon Valley is at its heart, I believe, a culture. And it's hard to transplant a culture for the same reason it's hard to transplant an organ. The host rejects it in a way. It's not a good fit. And this is why, you know, despite probably the hundreds of attempts to replicate Silicon Valley, it's not worked. And it's not worked because you can't transplant a culture, and you certainly can't do it, you know, in 1, 2, or 3 years or this short time frame that people expect it to take root. However, you can learn some lessons about innovation and creativity from Silicon Valley, but then you have to have it grow in a more organic way in London or Dubai or wherever it is.
And yet politicians all over the world are constantly promising that they are going to put in policies that encourage an explosion of creativity and economic growth.
And they don't work. They don't work. And in China, I was in China researching the book, and you hear a lot of hand-wringing. Can you hear hand-wringing? I guess you can hear it if it's loud enough, right?
It's loud enough.
Yeah. You hear a lot of hand-wringing in China.
You have a good microphone. Yeah.
Right, about what they call the innovation gap, you know. And people will say, well, everything's made in China, but nothing's invented here. You know, where's the Chinese Steve Jobs? And I was actually watching a panel discussion on CCTV, Chinese television, and one of the panelists said, well, we need a government innovation program. The government needs to start an innovation program, and just the way they built, you know, bridges and high-speed rail, they need to create innovation. And it's borderline laughable because it doesn't work that way in a top-down way. And, you know, the fact that someone would suggest that in China probably indicates that there's a problem there.
But is there any place, any moment in time where you saw government policy making a difference, at least encouraging something that was already happening?
Often it's unintentional. It wasn't the government per se. It was the church, but close enough in Scotland, called the Kirk. That's the name for the church. And they decided that they needed a massive literacy campaign, because there was great illiteracy all over Scotland. It was one of the most illiterate, poorest countries in Europe. And they wanted people to read the Bible. So they go to every hamlet and village and they spread literacy and so people can read the word. But it turns out that they don't read the word. They read other words. They read Milton and Shakespeare.
And they want to write.
And they've got some pretty wild, subversive ideas. You know, David Hume and Adam Smith and the rest. So institutions like religion and government can play inadvertent roles. Look, I mean, there's no doubt that the defense contractors and the government by extension played a role in Silicon Valley. It's debatable how much of a role. I think it was part of the mix. I don't think anyone thinks it was the only factor. The fact is that war is actually bad for innovation and creativity.
Is
all
it?
All-out war.
That's not a commonly held thought, is
no.
it?
No. And again, I'll defer to Dean Simonton at UC Davis, who has crunched the numbers and determined that if you look over the course of history, actual war, maybe not a cold war, but actual war is not good for creativity. How many geniuses are coming out of Syria right now?
Well, but that's just one example. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci came up with some awesome innovations,
he did, but in the
service of warlords.
Right, but not in the midst of war. When you're being shot at, all your creativity is channeled into either how to shoot back with a better gun or how to run away. I mean, it does channel our creative energies, but into fairly narrow places. All these golden ages when they were sparking in different directions, arts, science, literature, like Vienna of 1900, for instance, or 1920s Paris, they were essentially at peace. They are often sandwiched between wars. There might be tension in the air. That's an important ingredient. But all-out war, no, that's not good for creativity.
Well, let's take another call now. We've got Philip in Mill Valley.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm getting the book now, looking forward to it. And so my question is, perhaps if you could talk about a locality within these particular places that foster geniuses. And I'm thinking of everything from, the Athenian Forum and Roman Forum to the Tuscan Villas to the Viennese cafes, London and Edinburgh coffee houses. And then what he thinks maybe has the same sort of, kind of localities within places of foster geniuses today, maybe online forums. And I'll take my question off the air.
Great. Thanks, Philip. Great question. Because the genius that takes place in these genius clusters, doesn't just happen in an abstract way. It happens in very small, concrete places, like you suggested. Let's take the coffee houses of Vienna of 1900. I mean, these were incredibly popular. And partly people went there because housing was very tight. There was not a lot of heating and it was cold, but the coffee houses were warm. And for a very small amount of money, you can get your coffee and you can get your conversation. They were the internet of the day. The newspapers were all lined up on these wooden sticks, as they still are today. And people read the newspapers and they conversed. And again, they conversed with people with a diversity of ideas and backgrounds. I mean, if you walked into a coffee shop in Vienna of 1902, you could conceivably find at the same table the artist Gustav Klimt, Sigmund Freud, the writer Stefan Zweig, and Adolf Hitler. Hitler was probably too broke at the time for the coffee house even, but they were all there living in the city at the same time. And, one, it's not the coffee. I looked into this and I was very kind of...
Well, there is that kind of buzzy drug. And in your book, you talk about alcohol being a helpful facilitator.
Alcohol is helpful. Actually, coffee is less helpful for creativity because it narrows your focus. And it sort of channels your mental energy into a narrower and narrower space. Alcohol has a disinhibiting effect. And that's powerful. And it defocuses you. A little bit of alcohol makes you more creative. A lot of alcohol makes you fall down. And that's not creative. But I wanted to get back to Philip's question. So the coffee houses and the ambient noise, it turns out that researchers have found that 70 decibels is the ideal noise level for creative thinking. Not complete silence, not library quiet, not in a construction site, not that much noise. But enough background noise so that you defocus your attention. And maybe you found this, Rachel, that you're more creative.
Absolutely.
With a little background noise.
Actually, cafes work great for writing for me anyway.
Yeah. So, and they still play that role today, although there's less conversation and more people clicking on their keyboard in Starbucks.
Well, let's get to a few more listener comments. Miguel tweets, if we're talking about Silicon Valley being a place where great ideas flow, what about places like Hollywood? Example, George Lucas. Ali writes, Virginia Woolf explored the question, what if Shakespeare had a sister in her 1929 essay, A Room of One's Own? It's true we don't have many culturally recognized female geniuses. Is that because we still don't value or see women's brilliance as much as men?
Let me take that question because it's a really good one. And people often ask me, like, why are there so few women geniuses in your book? And the answer, and bear with me on this, is that there were so few women geniuses. And why is that? Well, if you believe in the myth that genius is genetic, then you would have to conclude the reason there's so few women geniuses is because women are somehow genetically inferior. And let me be clear, I'm not saying that. Okay. Now, if you believe that genius is all about hard work, you would have to say, well, there's so few women geniuses because they don't work hard. But if you believe that geniuses are grown in the soil and that culture matters, then you have to conclude the reason there's so few women geniuses is because the jurors, men, have historically and traditionally not acknowledged them, not given them, A, the opportunity, and B, the recognition.
It gets to that recognition factor. If your brother gets credited for the work you actually half wrote, or your name is left off the discussions of the scientific paper you actually led the writing of.
Does the name Nannerl mean anything to you?
No.
Nannerl Mozart was Mozart's sister, 3 or 4 years his elder. by all accounts, at least as talented as Wolfgang Amadeus, perhaps more talented. Today, Nannerl Mozart has a schnapps in Austria named after her, which I'm told is quite good, but we don't know her or her work because she wasn't given the opportunity or the recognition. And I think, if anything, that sort of proves my thesis that creative genius is a cultural construct to a large extent.
What was it you were saying earlier, that the genius has to be able to see something others don't see, but then others have to be able to see
right,
to
hit the target.
Genius. Yeah.
It was Schopenhauer, and he said that talent hits the target no one else can hit. Genius hits the target no one else can see. And I would add, once a genius hits that unseen target, everyone's like, ah, there's a target there. Otherwise, he's, you know, Don Quixote and not quite a genius, perhaps.
Let's head to another call. And is it Nerio in Sonoma?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Well, it's not a question. I just want to – you're saying so many wonderful, interesting things. one thing about – first of all, I'm an immigrant. I've been here about 28 years. I'm an artist, a sculptor, designer. I speak 4.5 languages. I'm learning another one. But just the same way that a stupid doesn't know how stupid he is, a genius knows how little genius he is. In other words, I am a little one. In other words, I am very, very creative. And I wanted to say that for my observation, first of all, creativity is something that you have inside to some extent. And then it's like a plant. You put it in a fertile ground and it blooms, greatly. So I moved to the United States, and in about 10 years, I accomplished what I didn't accomplish in 30 years in my country. The situation has changed here. So now there's a little less fertile ground.
And why is that, Nerio? What is it you feel has made it less amenable to success?
Unfortunately, I have to say that it's a the distribution of wealth. In other words, the middle class is what was fueling my work. You know, I'm a sculptor. I design different things, lamps, tables, gates, all sort of things. And my business has gone down. But apart from that, another issue another point that I would like to make is creativity goes in waves. And if you go back to the chakra system, the creativity chakra is right above the sexuality chakra. So I found in my life that the sexuality being the lowest valve. So if you open that, you lower the energy. So you're less creative. If you close
I'm going to stop you there, Nerio, because we want other people to get a chance to weigh into the conversation. But thank you. Carl tweets, geography of genius. Well, certainly cultural geography. The seed of genius grows in its own supporting culture. That seems to be something we keep coming back to.
Yeah. And it is culture. It is, I quickly dismiss the theory that it's sunshine and weather. Ancient Athens, like Athens today, has 300 days a year of beautiful sunshine. But look at Elizabethan London, where Shakespeare did his work.
If there wasn't natural fog, they were creating pollution to mimic it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's not the weather. And in fact, what's interesting is a lot of these places were unexpected in that they didn't have a lot going for them. The land in Athens was very arid. It wasn't very fertile. Florence was kind of a swampy, malarial city. They're often not places rich with abundant resources.
So it's not the sunshine. Pete asks a question that gets back to your time at NPR. Why is Washington the opposite of genius?
Ooh. I think it comes down to risk and the lack of risk-taking and boldness. You know, creative genius and caution don't really go hand in hand very well. And I live in Washington for reasons unclear to me, but there's a sense of caution and a lack of risk taking. And ultimately, you know, that's what you need. You need to not just hire someone because they've done the exact same task somewhere else, but to hire them because you see some talent in them and give them an impossible task. You know, Michelangelo was not the best fit to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. He had not done much painting. He was mostly into statuary, putting it mildly. He was a great statue maker. And yet Pope Julius II said, I'm going to bet on you. I'm going to take a chance on you. I'm going to give you a job that looks like a bad fit. It's risk-taking. And Washington, not known for its risk-taking.
Could it also be, I mean, when you think about it, Washington is a place that draws from all over the world the best and the brightest of a certain kind.
But you're talking about Congress?
Well, no. I mean, there are a lot of great minds who go there, yeah. You know, with great ambitions, but then their genius is bent to tasks. You know, it's a kind of an ecosystem that requires a kind of perversion of effort to succeed within that system instead of coming up with great ideas that serve greater goals.
Go back to Plato's quote, what is honored in a place is cultivated there. What is honored in Washington? Is it beauty? Is it risk-taking? Is it creative leaps? No. And so that's what you get.
Beautifully put. Well, let's go to another call, Austin in Berkeley.
Hi, thank you so much for the discussion today. I'm absolutely in love with it. And I live in the Bay Area and I've been a kind of a student of the creativity and innovation that's here. I actually graduated from Berkeley with a major in geography, attained a master's in architecture later on, and write on creativity myself. And I once asked a Taoist master of feng shui, you know, could you tell me what's the energetic aspect of the outpouring of creativity in the Bay Area? And he said, first of all, there's no such thing as good or bad feng shui. That's sort of a Western conceptualization. But the Bay Area is particularly an unusual feng shui in that we have the Pacific Ocean to the west, which is the ultimate yin environment, cold, dark, shape-shifting. And then to the east, we have the ultimate yang environment, which is the Central Valley, hot, dry, highly cultivated. And those two air masses, one comes down the Cartina Strait, the other one through the Golden Gate, and we get this swirling of potentiality that's there. And I think that, you know, in terms of geography, I'm just wondering what other areas within the world have you seen in terms of the book that you've studied that have this same sort of geographical aspect to it that starts to fuel that particular creativity?
That's a good question, Austin. And I'm no expert on feng shui, that's for sure. But, you know, there are microclimates in the Bay Area and there are microcultures. And in that sense, it's a little bit like ancient Greece, where you had hundreds of city-states, Athens just being the best known, but there are hundreds of them. And because the land was rocky and hilly and they were separated, cut off from one another, little microcultures developed. And that's good for creativity, to have these microcultures and microclimates. And Austin's right that there, just as there is maybe no good or bad feng shui, there's really no place that can't be a genius cluster. It's how people react to the challenge. I really believe that creativity is a reaction to a challenge, to constraints. And, you know, as I said, you know, Florence, not only was it malarial and had no open water port, just the Arno River, it had been decimated by the Black Death, the plague, wiping out a third of the population. Two generations later, you see the flourishing of the Renaissance. And that's often the case. Something bad happens, stirs up the pot, but it, in a good way, in the sense that new possibilities are opened up.
I also wonder, maybe not in the case of Florence, but certainly Athens, you're talking about a port city, London, a port city.
Yes.
Here, not Edinburgh,
San Francisco.
Glasgow. Here. And, you know, there's a very, we're consciously aware of being, citizens of the Pacific Rim. And there's a lot of back and forth with Asia
right.
on the West Coast.
And that means a lot of borrowing / stealing. I mean, that's one thing I think Silicon Valley has in common with ancient Athens. And maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, but not a lot was invented here, but a lot was perfected here. It's not where ideas are born, but it's where they come of age. And that was true in Athens, too. Getting back to our favorite dude, Plato, he said, what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. The foreigners might have called it stealing, okay, instead of borrowing.
Right.
But it's true. And there's great genius in perfecting, you know, and this is actually, speaking of feng shui, this is the Chinese approach to creativity. The Chinese believe that in the beginning there wasn't nothing. There was always something. And so what the creative person does is not create something ex nihilo from nothing, but they rearrange the stuff that's already there. And that's still creative.
Alan writes on Facebook, the influence of Buddhism from Japan and China drew people from all across the country to the Bay Area in the 50s and 60s. The influence of Buddhism can be seen in the music, writing, and visual art of the time.
Hmm.
Nick writes, don't mistake moving fast, move fast and break things for genius. Also, Beijing is considered to be a massive tech hub now.
Getting there, yeah. And I think Mark Zuckerberg, he amended that to move fast. He dropped the break things part, which I think is wisely a good idea. I'm a little skeptical of the obsession with disruption for disruption's sake. I think disruption should be maybe a side effect of creativity, a means to an end. I don't think it should be an end in itself.
One last question for you. Hmm. Any question from this book that you now want to explore?
Ooh, you know, okay, I'll be perfectly honest, Rachel. There's sort of, there's a mystery that remains here. It remains on the scale of place and on the scale of person. For instance, many geniuses suffered traumatic childhoods. A disproportionately large number lost a parent when they were young. And some go on to become delinquents and depressives, and others go on to be geniuses. Why the difference?
That's your next book, then.
I hope so, yeah.
We've been talking with Eric Weiner, author of The Geography of Genius. He's going to be at Kepler's in Menlo Park tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. and at Book Passage in Corte Madera on Friday at 7 p.m. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Myra.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.